Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. For the month of September, I was on solitary retreat for the most part, and soon followed by a weeks-long visit to my family in Massachusetts. And so this is the first occasion to give a reflection about a month now. So I'm a little rusty with the speech faculty and maybe with the organization of thought faculty as well. So I'm not quite sure how it will all tumble out. I had a very good retreat in many ways, as I've mentioned to some other people, not always physically easy. There were some challenges with the intense heat of the afternoons, and I somehow picked up a chest cold, I think, when I was down at Spirit Rock during that first week. And so kind of was hacking my way through a few weeks of that retreat, but still found it a very useful period of time. And I was started out just, I had a book that I was reading a little bit, in addition to Dhamma books. I had another one just for a bit of change of pace, and it was a book by a physician named Atul Gawande, who has written several books. He's a doctor in the Boston area, and he, last year I think it was, or sometime very recently, another book came out called Being Mortal. And actually I think Debbie gave that to me as a birthday present, and so I spent the first week or two, couple of weeks, reading that in the evenings. And right at the very beginning is a quote that he put in there on the just before the title page, and it's from the Mahabharata, the epic Indian poem, of which I don't know very much, but this quote struck me, and it's kind of, I find myself revisiting it and repeating it. It's very short, but I find myself thinking about it frequently, and it's from one of the warriors in the poem. And it's and what he says is, I see it now. This world is swiftly passing. And that kind of sets the stage for very fruitful contemplation. I see it now. This world is swiftly passing. Appropriate for the introduction to his book, because his book is largely on the aging process, particularly as it's happening in the West now, a bit about illness and death as well, of course, but largely centering, focusing on the process of getting old and what happens. And so that formed a basis for contemplation for much of the retreat for me. Because when you think about it, you know, we come into this world, and for a number of years we're quite dependent. You know, early in our life, we're very dependent on adults, usually parents, mother, father, taking care of us, changing our diapers, feeding us, looking after our very basic personal needs, just for survival. And then a little bit later on, training us in coping skills, how to make it through a lifetime So early on, for a number of years, we're quite dependent. And then we have this period of time where we're independent, living life in a relatively, usually, in a relatively healthy body, being productive members of society and engaging in the world in various ways. And then as we get closer to the end of our life, oftentimes, in the aging process, we're back in that dependent position, back to needing help from other people, sometimes our children, sometimes other people that we find ourselves in communion with, or sometimes hired people, and back maybe needing somebody to cook for us and somebody to feed us and somebody to help change our diapers. So there's this, you know, on either end of our lives, we're in this, we can be anyway, in a relatively dependent state, and we have this, what's looking to me more and more like this very narrow period in between that we can actually focus on whatever it is that we want to focus on, how we want to live our lives, what we can learn from this human existence. And I was just looking in the room around us, people were taking the precepts and just noticing that, you know, pretty much all of us in the room are within that narrow window, some at the very beginning of that window and some getting towards the end of that window, and pretty much everywhere in between. But, you know, here we are taking advantage of that opportunity in this short period of functionality. But it is swiftly passing. The book itself, I found very useful and unique in a way, because so much of popular literature and in this area, at least that I've encountered, has been more focused on the dying process, and we even get a lot of contemplations and encouragement from the scriptures, the Buddhist teachings, to really bring contemplation of death into our practice as a primary reflection. It has a very powerful effect on the heart if we do it correctly and do it frequently, because the process of dying and death is an opportunity to really sharpen one's focus. It's not only a time to examine philosophical issues, really brings to the fore, you know, what is it? How did I get here? Where am I going? But it also tunes us into and challenges some of our basic assumptions of who we are. And it's a very important time of life, and it's a very important contemplation to bring up to really reinforce how we need to examine our assumptions about who we are and what we're doing. And we know that the time of death is very potent also as a stepping stone into whatever it is that comes after it. So there's been a lot of focus on that period of life in the contemplations, and it's received a lot of attention in service areas too, the growing hospice movement, and looking after people who are dying, and how to support people in a very clear and conscious way who are in that process, and then as a self-reflection very special time. But something that I've kind of had a realization of for a while is in my adult life, in the work that I did, and also I thought this book did an excellent job of really spending most of the time in his writing just about the whole experience of old age, because it's not something that's as strongly immediate and potent as the contemplation of death and the attention that we put on that, but it's incredibly significant and becoming more significant in our society as modern medicine has been able to take care of various acute illnesses that have usually done us in before reaching too much of an old age. But in the past century or so, huge advances have been made, as he points out, that keep us going. You know, we're able to successfully deal with some of the things that took us out of existence earlier in life, heart disease and different kinds of cancers, and particularly infectious diseases. So there's been, you know, a lot of miraculous kinds of help that the medical world has brought into our lives. And more what we're being left with is an old age, and sometimes it's quite a healthy old age for many years, and other times it's not so healthy, and particularly as people get into their 80s and 90s. Even though there may not be any kind of like major organ system breaking down, there's just this constant and slow wearing away of the parts, so that you can't say there's anything dramatic happening, but little by little, day by day, month by month, year by year, the parts are just wearing out. The engine is slowing down. Different things need constant attention, fixing. And, you know, some of us are starting to experience little bits and pieces of it. But sometimes the whole experience of really long-term chronic disability, old age, just the getting old is not talked about so much. It's not contemplated so much. So I found that very, very helpful reminder to bring that possibility, that probability into consciousness for myself. And so instead of doing my oftentimes death reflection, I decided I'd just try and do an old age reflection and contemplate myself just being pretty incapacitated, but with no end in sight. You know, the thing about death contemplation is that there's an end in sight, and then the sort of the vast unknown about what comes afterwards. But with the contemplation on old age, imagining oneself just on the slow decline, with nothing in particular that's going to come along and end one's life. What's that like? What would that be like to be in a wheelchair, or maybe even in a bed, unable to get out of bed altogether for months and years, extraordinarily dependent on other people just to take care of the body, take care of this physical body, even to the point of, you know, changing position, having to have somebody turn me in bed, get me up, clean me up when I've soiled myself, maybe even having to feed me, and not have an end in sight. What would that be like? It's a challenging contemplation. It's hard to sustain that one for a long period of time, but I found that very, very useful. It can sound a bit bleak when I talk about these kinds of things, but What it leads one to is to, if you're reflecting appropriately, is to see, okay, well, there's a lot of suffering, to acknowledge that suffering that could be part and parcel of that process. And then to ask honestly, well, what is it that is the cause of that suffering? And how could a person in that situation, how can I in that situation be with it in a way that doesn't produce a lot of anxiety, fear, pain, grief? And how is it that one can get to the point where we could be just lying there day after day, month after month, year after year, with that happening, and not succumb to suffering? There's a sutta that has always been a favorite one of mine. Sometimes the Buddha talks in very stark language, ways that gets our attention. It's not always positive and you know, kind of inspiring in a beautiful kind of a way, but in ways that are meant to really wake us up, get us to think. One of those that I often think about and like to remind myself about is the one where Sariputta is talking with a monk named Yamaka, who has been caught in wrong view. And Yamaka holds this view that at the time of death, if one has done one's work and is a fully released, an arahant, that at the time of death, then one is essentially annihilated and no longer exists. And so he holds an annihilationist view and feels quite comfortable with that. And his fellow monks, you know, hear him espouse this view and admonish him as such, saying, you know, no, the Buddha didn't teach an annihilationist standpoint, but he insists on holding to it. So they report that to Sariputta, who comes and, you know, confirms with Yamaka that he does indeed hold that view, and then tries to challenge him about that. And basically he goes through a series of questions intended to get Yamaka to contemplate this more deeply, revolving around the questions that you see in other parts of the teachings as well, a series where he talks about, well, do you regard the Tathagata or one who is enlightened as being in form, or as being apart from form, as being possessed by form, or form as being involved in any way with this being that we call the Tathagata? The answer, of course, from Yamaka is no. And then Sariputta goes through all of the khandhas, the five khandhas, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness itself, and says, you know, can you regard the Tathagata as being associated with any of these five khandhas, either in possession of them, or as them being in him, or him being in them in any way whatsoever? Is that how one defines the Tathagata, either separately or in combination or as a whole of these five khandhas? And Yamaka says no. That's not possible to identify an enlightened being as in relationship to any of these five khandhas. So Sariputta's reply is, well, if you can't fathom an enlightened being in relation to any of these five khandhas while they're still alive, then how can you possibly say that at the time of death that the Tathagata, or an enlightened being, is annihilated? You know, if you can't make any kind of identification with what we know as the constituents of existence in the here and now, in this present form, then how can you say that there is an annihilation at the time of death? And he realizes, Yamaka realizes the folly of his view, his annihilationist view, with that discussion. And then Sariputta goes further to clarify it with a very striking simile. And he says, suppose there was a wealthy man who enjoyed all the fine things in life and was looking for a servant. There is this man who was intent on killing this wealthy man, and he decided to see if he could be hired on as a servant. So he asked this wealthy man if he could be hired on as his servant. And, of course, this wealthy man didn't know that there was an intention on this other fellow to do him in. So he said, well, let's give it a try. And so the new servant begins to work for this man and is very diligent, very attentive, gets up before the wealthy man arises, has everything prepared, serves him well during the day, takes care of all of his needs, is there when he is needed and is not there when he is not needed, and helps the man and is there when he retires and doesn't go to bed himself until after the wealthy man retires. And so he endears himself in a way and gets him to be used to him and to count on him. And he really engenders the trust of his employer. And then what happens is that the man with the intent to kill realizes that he's wrapped him up in his web of deceit. And when there is a moment when the wealthy man is alone, he stabs him, kills him, does him in. So a very stark kind of example, and the association that is drawn is that first of all, what Sariputta asks is when that before that man was hired, did the wealthy man know that this man was a murderer? And the answer is no. And while he was gaining his trust and working for him, did the wealthy man know that this man was a murderer? And the answer is no. And at the time, just right up until the time that the murder happened, did this wealthy man know that this other man was a murderer? The answer is no. And the implication then that is drawn is that this is how we live in relationship to our five khandhas: form, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. We indulge in them as who we are. We engage with them as a vehicle for enjoyment, for pleasure. We trust in them. Wake up in the morning, and there it is, our trusty friend, this human body, this mind, these mental faculties. Engage with them through the day in using them for enjoyment, pleasure, and we believe in them. We believe that they are ours as a vehicle for enjoyment. We use them in that way. We come to identify with them very strongly as who we are. And they're still with us when we go to sleep, when we go to bed. There they are, our trusty friends, body, feelings, perceptions, thoughts, ideas, emotions, consciousness, all there with us as we go to sleep. We wake up again And there they are, ready to serve us. But then in the end, they turn against us. And all along the time, all along the way, we didn't know that they would turn against us in the end. And that's what's happening as we get older, as we get sick, as we start to realize that all the trust and faith and hope and reliance that we've placed on these khandhas to give us a sense of pleasure, to give us a sense of identity, it's starting to turn against us. It's starting to fade, just like the murderer. So a very stark, very clear image that the Buddha presents for us to help us wake up, to come to our senses and see the assumptions we've been making all along, the ones we've been counting on all along for a sense of stability. So if we can take it on ourselves to contemplate something like old age before we're starting to be moved into the experience of increasing dependence as the khandhas start to turn against us, as our bodies start to get old and sick, then that provides an opportunity to head off the suffering, head off the suffering at the pass. The last week, just up until a couple of days ago, I spent with my family back in Massachusetts and was able to get some good experience with this whole area a little bit more closely, because my mother is 91, 92 in January. And it's been a tough year for her. She's had her definite moments when her body has been turning against her. But she's an example of one of these folks that's just, she doesn't have any kind of really major outstanding life-threatening condition. She doesn't really have heart disease. She doesn't have cancer. She has a few minor problems, blood pressure, high blood pressure, borderline diabetes. But she's got a lot of aches and pains from arthritis, slowing down, and everything takes a lot longer to do. She's still living alone, but as I've been telling other people, she walks with a wheeled walker very, very slowly. The body just doesn't have enough energy. There's pain from the arthritis. And she's had a number of falls in the past year. There's nothing that's going to be at least taking her anytime soon that we can tell. Very hard of hearing, very isolated with sensory deprivation. Vision is starting to decline so that nothing is enjoyable anymore, really. She can't hear conversations very well. She can't hear the TV. The brightness even of the TV hurts her eyes after a period of time. It's not comfortable to read. Takes her good hour in the morning just to prepare her breakfast and eat it, and you know, good 45 minutes at least to just get dressed in the morning. So much of her day is just spent doing the things that we take for granted. And you know, my 24-year-old nephew was remembering, as we were talking about this, he was remembering how just a few years ago when he was living at home and he had to get up to go to school, how he would set the alarm for 10 to 7 because the bus was coming at 7:02. And how he would still not get up because he hated getting up. And so he figured that he could actually, he got it down to getting up at 7:02. P- pulling on his clothes, stuffing something into his mouth as he was running out to catch the bus 4 minutes later. He could do it all in 4 minutes. And we were noticing the stark difference between that and my mother, who spends most of the morning just doing the same thing. So I got to really see this firsthand, and how somebody in this kind of situation, barely able to move and keep going, makes it through a day, and then kind of reverses the process at the end of the day to undo it all, get undressed, go to bed, with not a whole lot in between, seems like. So I got to see that as a, you know, upfront contemplation, and talking with my sister and my mother about if she's safe, you know, issues like safety versus independence. And really seeing firsthand how the, you know, the body and the cognitive processes are not providing what we thought all along they should be providing, what we took for granted as a means of having satisfaction, pleasure in life. They're not doing that anymore. I had some conversations with my mother, and she just, like all of us, are saying, you know, why can't I just die in my sleep? You know, we would all love that. And you know, it very rarely happens. And yeah, just a very, very poignant kind of reminder of what the possibilities are for all of us. So that can inspire a sense of despair if one doesn't use it wisely, or it can inspire a sense of urgency that now, while we're in this narrow window, we can use this opportunity to contemplate the teachings. What is it that, where is it that we can take refuge if we can't take refuge in this body and in this mind? Where is it that we can turn to? Is there a way out of this suffering? And of course, there is. After we fully examine these first two noble truths of suffering and the cause of suffering, then we realize there is a path that leads to the release from it, as we're all sitting here as evidence that this is something that we can look into, take refuge in. So the sense of urgency is something that can come up from the contemplation of old age. Also, something that another teaching that I mentioned earlier, I think in one of the morning reflections that I was contemplating a lot during my retreat, is kind of a reflection again on these five khandhas in a way that is a contemplation meant to lead to the insight that this is not who we are. A very brief teaching from the Buddha, but very, very useful for me in my contemplation during the retreat, was that the Buddha, through an analogy, asked the monks, you know, suppose there's people gathering in the woods, gathering sticks and grass and pieces of wood to throw on a fire, to feed the fire. If you saw somebody doing that, would you say, stop, stop, that's me you're picking up, that's me you're gathering together to throw on this fire, stop that? You know, does that make any sense? And they reply, no, because, you know, that grass, those sticks, those pieces of wood, that's not who we are. It doesn't matter. That's, you know, that's just grass and sticks and pieces of wood from the forest. Doesn't matter to me whether they're thrown on the fire or not. And the Buddha says, so too, you know, whatever it is, monks, whatever it is that isn't yours, don't cling to it. Let it go, abandon it. Whatever the sticks and grass and woods that are not yours, so you don't hold on to it. So whatever is whatever isn't yours, don't hold on. Don't hold on to it. What is it, bhikkhus? What is it that is not yours? Form is not yours. Abandon it. Relinquish it. Don't attach to it. Feelings are not yours. Don't attach. Don't cling. Relinquish. Perceptions are not yours. Thoughts, ideas, emotions, all mental formations, they're not yours. Consciousness is not yours. Abandon them all. Let them go. Relinquish them. Abandon whatever isn't yours. In other words, you have no right to hold all these constituents of existence, these aggregates, what we think of as mine, or what we identify with. We have no right to hold them in that way. So don't cling to them. Don't hold to them. They are just what they are. And the more we contemplate that over and over again, the more we don't have an investment in this body and these mental faculties as the sole means, as the means for providing a sense of pleasure, a sense of continuity, a sense of safety, a sense of refuge. We just little by little abandon that false notion of this is where we can find comfort and security. And as we do that, we start to open up more towards what it is that's not part of this whole system of creation. Open up to what is not part of the conditioned realm. See more clearly, little by little, how clinging and identification and ignorance is the cause of suffering in our lives. And we have the opportunity to let go of that. So that if we live through an old age, if we don't get a catastrophic illness that takes us out quickly, you know, maybe we'll have a chance of living gracefully through that latter part, that old age, that decline, that dependence, in a way that is with an easy heart, not expecting it to be comfortable and wonderful and, you know, exciting or blissful or anything, but just to be able to live with a simplicity and ease of being, because we know that's not who we are. So that's just a few reflections for people to contemplate as I've been thinking about them over the past month, and hope that it's of some benefit.